Hello and welcome to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies, where writers of African American life and culture discuss their new books. I'm your host, Sherry Johnson, and today I'm happy to speak with Vershawn Ashanti Young, professor in the English department at the University of Kentucky and editor of From Bourgeois to Bougie, Black Middle Class Performances, published in 2011 by Wayne State University Press. If you want to learn more about the historical representations of class amongst Black communities and how they play out in the contemporary society, if you're interested in the intertwined relationship between behavior and class presentations, if you want to know more about performance, both in the fine arts as well as within the contours of everyday life, Vershawn A. Young's edited collection shares lessons that you just don't want to miss. In our conversation, the professor discusses varied types of performance in terms of responsibility, womanhood, media, and sexuality, all within the Black middle class. I enjoyed our conversation. I know you will too. Listen in. Okay, good afternoon, Vershawn. How are you?
I'm very fine, Sherry. Good afternoon to you.
I'm so happy you're able to join us today to talk about your book, From Bourgeois to Bougie, Black Middle Class Performances. Before we jump into our discussion, I just want to share with the listeners a little bit about you. Why don't you say a few words about yourself? Like maybe, you know, where you were born, raised, etc.
Well, I was born and raised in Chicago, Illinois. And I spent quite a bit of time in Chicago right up until the time I graduated from high school. Then I went to undergraduate school at Southern Illinois University in Edwardsville. Mm-hmm. I graduated with a degree in English and speech theater, and I became a high school English and drama teacher. Mm-hmm. And then I went back to Chicago, got two master's degrees, one in performance studies, mm-hmm. another one in educational administration. Okay. I worked as an elementary principal.
Wow.
And then went to graduate school, got a PhD in English and African American Studies from the University of Illinois at Chicago. Mm-hmm. And my first academic job was actually at the University of Iowa, mm-hmm. where I was an assistant professor in African American Studies and rhetoric for 7 years, was tenured there, and was recruited to the University of Kentucky, where I am now as an associate professor in English, American Studies, and Gender and Women's Studies.
Okay, wow. You know, we have something in common. I too first was a high school English teacher before I went back to graduate school.
Oh wow!
Right? Yay. Yeah. So I think that we do it better. I really think that people who are trained to be teachers are really great professors.
Yes.
At least that's been my experience.
Yes.
All right. So performance then seems to be a common thread or link in everything that you've just outlined in terms of you know, your interests, your academic interests, or your personal interests. So why don't you tell us a little bit how you became interested in performance, and then further, I guess, to bourgeois or bougie?
Yes. Okay. Well, when I was younger, my family used to have these yearly gatherings just for the family, but friends of the family would come too, and we would always perform. There was always a showcase. Mm-hmm. And we would vary what we did. I mean, my sisters and I would sing, we would dance, we would do original poetry that we read, we would read poems and excerpts from well-known authors, etc. So I come from a culturally diverse performance background, just, you know, from my upbringing. Mm-hmm. And in school, I was always interested in the oratory contests, mm-hmm. and I would always win mm-hmm. these vocal speaking contests. And so performance as a mode of interacting, as a way of representation and presenting material has always been a part of my family and academic life. Mm-hmm. And I'm also trained as an actor, and I work as a solo performance. Mm-hmm. So artistic performance is important to me, obviously. Mm-hmm. But performance studies as a field, which I'm also trained in,
right,
is views performance very broadly, so that performance is not only artistic performance, mm-hmm, engaging in singing and dancing, etc., or performances that we see like rituals, etc., but it's also seeing everyday interaction through the lens of theatricality as a performance, seeing language as a performance. So everything becomes performative in that way.
Sure.
And so I, as a person who has increased his class status from the underclass or lower working classes to the middle class, I see and engage in different performative modes. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm, I could see ways of engaging with lower class or working class African Americans, mm-hmm, as well as with middle class African Americans, and the ways in which others perceive working and middle class African Americans, and the way in which they perceive me, but just based upon my racial identity,
right,
and ways in which they expect me to perform.
Sure.
Sometimes I defy those performances,
right,
and they cause, sometimes it causes tensions, mm-hmm, and conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I exceed the expectation of those performances, and sometimes those present challenges as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that really is sort of like the personal impetus to this book, From Bourgeois to Bougie,
mm-hmm,
because the middle class has gotten a lot of attention in these last several years. I mean the middle class overall, not just the African American middle class.
Right.
So we see that with the fall of the American economy, one of the big talking points in the last presidential election of 2008 and in this current one for 2012 is the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do we save America's middle class? And so everyone has become middle class.
Right. It's the thing to be. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But more particularly, we see that in this economy that African Americans have been hit the most,
right,
in terms of their financial stability.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, how does that economic as well as social and performative modes affect the Black middle class? And that's really what brought us, you know, to this book, those kinds of ideas, although the idea was germinating well before the 2008 election. But it's that kind of, you know, that kind of social discourse that brought me to do this book.
Sure. Okay, good. You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking, you know, we're in this academia, we're in academia, and I wonder, who were your mentors? Who kind of helped to foster this kind of the understanding of performance as a very fruitful space for academic study? It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it?
It does, in a way.
Yeah.
It seems counterintuitive to those of us who are outside of performance studies or theater.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it seems very intuitive to people who are in performance studies.
Yeah.
As I said, I have a master's degree in performance studies, and some of those people that I studied under are not well known in the field. But some of the people that I that inspire me, such as E. Patrick Johnson,
okay,
at Northwestern University,
mm-hmm,
and you know, we're friends and colleagues, and he also wrote the foreword to this book.
Yeah,
and his work very much uses the intertwined lens of race, mm-hmm, and performance in order to discuss gender,
sure,
particularly masculinity,
mm-hmm,
mm-hmm, as well as class politics.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that kind of lineage. I can cite some other people like Brian Keith Alexander,
mm-hmm,
at Cal State, Jeffrey McCune at Maryland, who's also my colleague in performance studies, Soyini Madison. These are performance studies scholars in particular who are very much interested in the kinds of topics that I am. So I read their work regularly. They're interested in race and gender and class as well.
Yeah. Okay, good. All right. So your title, your book, I love. And one of the things that brought me to it was the title, From Bourgeois to Bougie, Black Middle Class Performances, as well as the artwork. And we'll get to discussing the artwork shortly. But it seems then that there are three particular terms, maybe some might say all of the terms need to be defined. But I'm interested in, and you've already begun to talk about performance and the broad ways in which you look at it or are interested in studying it. Can you just talk to me a little bit about performance? I want to read for you a quotation from E. Patrick Johnson's foreword. He said, I personally experienced material poverty, but also enjoyed a front row seat for some of the most intricate performances of middle class. And I know many of us who can relate. In the quotation, he introduces performance as something we witness, but also something in which we all engage. And so I really want you to just lay out for us some of the definitions of performance that one can find within the text.
Okay. I'm going to point to my introduction in which I tried to talk about the difference between a performance as a definition between blacks and whites in particular, because one of the things that our culture wants to do is we want to make the experiences of middle class whites and blacks exactly the same in order to say that we've achieved an egalitarian society where civil rights works for African Americans now. And so I'm trying to point out how performance allows us to see that that's not really the case right now. And in the introduction on page 20, I appeal to one of the theorist in performance studies, Richard Schechner, and how he defines performance. I'm just going to read a little bit.
Sure.
It says how performing race differs for middle class blacks than for, say, middle class whites can be understood from what Schechner explains as the difference between performing that is playing a role in everyday life and someone being herself. To be myself is to behave in a relaxed and unguarded manner. To perform myself means to take on the appearance, voice, and actions of the role or persona. And so I use examples of African Americans having to, being required to, take on a role in everyday life when, in fact, they should be able to be relaxed and be themselves. So I use the example of Condoleezza Rice when she goes into the jewelry store. And because of the color of her skin, the clerk shows her faux jewelry and she huffs and puffs and basically says, I want to see the good stuff because she's, you know, middle class. I use a literary example from Charles Chestnut's House Behind the Cedars to show how Dr. William Miller, who's a middle class black doctor, has to try to assert his middle classness, that he's wearing a suit and speaks with a kind of heightened dialect and is different from the African-Americans who the text seems to suggest should be in the Jim Crow car. So he's saying that based on his class, he shouldn't be there. So my point here is saying that if we look at how these actors, and I'm using actors in a broad sense, these performers, these people have to perform their racial identity in everyday life just to get the rights and privileges that they should have based on being a human being.
Correct.
Anyway, we could see how African Americans still have a way to go to achieving equality, full first class citizenship in the United States.
Definitely.
I wanna, if you'll allow me to point out another definition of performance that is illustrated by the sociologist, and his name is escaping me right at the moment. St. Clair Drake, the famous sociologist, St. Clair Drake.
Okay.
And in the documentary, Still a Brother, by William Greaves, St. Clair Drake outlines how performance really is key in distinguishing or understanding the Black middle class from the Black lower class. When he says that they're two men, they both make the same amount of money, they both work the same kind of job, and they both go home, but one man goes home and his wife takes a, you know, somewhat of a long time to answer the door, and when he gets inside, he pulls down the shade and beats her. And then after he's done beating her, they sit at the table and talk about their finances and planning for their children's college education. And then he says that the lower class man, however, goes into the house after his wife takes a while to answer the door. He then beats her with the shades open.
Right, right. Everyone can see.
So everyone could see.
Right.
You know, and before he went home, he imbibed, you know, a few drinks and so forth. So class in this instance that St. Clair Drake was trying to point out was not necessarily about the difference in income or the difference in work that these people were doing, but based upon how they behave
in
society.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so those are the kinds of we have. I am arguing that we have codified certain behaviors to exemplify or represent middle class people or underclass people. And it sort of gets us in a double bind. Right. Mm-hmm. And performance helps us to, I think, to tease that apart.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. Good. I wanted to talk. That was one of the terms I wanted to talk about, class and the way in which E. Patrick Johnson, you know, opens your text by talking about intra-racial class divisions and your articulation just now about class, not necessarily in terms of economics, but certainly in terms of behavior, is critical to understanding one of the main distinctions, I would say, between middle classes, I guess, in the U.S., middle classes. Mm-hmm. If you think of race as a distinction between the various kinds of middle classes in the U.S.
Yes.
All right. So that's fine. What about bourgeois? I mean, this is just put them together, bourgeois and bougie, and the distinctions between them. I mean, very important for us for our discussion.
Yes. Thank you for asking about that. Well, you know, the title is an obvious allusion to E. Franklin Frazier's classic study of 1955, when it was published in Europe, in 1957, and when it was published in the U.S., Black Bourgeoisie.
Mm-hmm.
And so from bourgeois references that study to bougie, which is a class that E. Franklin Frazier says that he didn't really discuss. And that class of people that he said he omitted from study are people who were allowed to, or who took advantage of civil rights legislation to increase their class status. In other words, educational opportunities were now open to them. Affirmative action opportunities were now open to them. And so they could have come from a lower class background, and these opportunities allowed them to increase their status to, middle class, a solid middle class standing. But because they don't have the heritage, basically, of having old money, so to speak, or coming from a recognized family, or having mixed race ancestry, which was also important for Black middle class heritage in E. Franklin Frazier's study, these people's bourgeois status can be contested.
Mm-hmm.
And so bougie becomes a sort of pejorative term.
Yeah.
For those individuals, it challenges their validity in a bourgeois society or as part of the Black bourgeois class. And this is important to understand because in both American society and in American and African American literature and discourse, there has always been a tendency on a part of some African Americans of middle class background to distinguish and separate themselves from underclass Blacks.
Mm-hmm.
And so that distinction between their solid bourgeois standing, and anybody else's contested bougie standing is very important to understand. I reference the Pew Research Center study of a few years ago that interviewed hundreds of middle-class African-Americans, in which they asked them, do you think that African-Americans are or constitute a single race? Mm-hmm. And middle-class Black people overall said no, that there's two races in Black culture, and that and the separation of those races is dependent on class. You have middle-class Blacks, and then you have a different race, and they are lower-class Blacks. Now, how class can separate somebody when race is supposed to be biological is really kind of, it blows my mind to, that people could think of it in that way.
Right.
But when we understand that in American society that race has always been classed, always. There, race has never not been a class distinction.
Yes.
America. Mm-hmm. Then we can understand what these middle-class Black people are getting at. They're appealing to the standard American ideology and discourse that says that your race is determined by your class, which your class is determined by certain cultural factors that you exhibit, and most of all, your behavior. Mm-hmm. And so that classic joke of Chris Rock's, when he distinguishes Black people and the N-word people, we can understand more palpably what that distinction is really trying to say. And I want to give you one other example that is so important.
Please do.
In 2004, at the 50th anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education, Bill Cosby gave his famous pound cake speech.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Bill Cosby was making the same distinction between middle-class African-Americans and underclass African-Americans. Right. Now, the problem with Bill Cosby's pound cake speech is that he seemed to suggest that because of the behavior of underclass or working-class African-Americans, that they deserve some of the ill treatment that they received from police officers, from the educational system, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And his argument essentially was if they change their behavior, then they wouldn't suffer such consequences. Mm-hmm. Now, on the surface, that seems like a valid argument.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about the fact that what one of the points that Bill Cosby raised was that people were getting shot, Black men were getting shot for stealing a piece of pound cake.
Right.
And he was saying, well, why are you saying that this is a bad thing that they've gotten shot? You should be teaching your son not to steal the pound cake. That's true.
Right.
But we live in a world, the entire world, where no human is perfect. People steal every day.
Right.
And our judicial system has codify certain consequences for certain crimes. And when you steal a piece of pound cake, you do not get the death sentence.
That's right.
So for Bill Cosby to argue that what's most important in that scenario is for the parent to train the child or the Black male not to steal the pound cake, as opposed to saying it's unfair and really wrong to shoot and execute Black men because they've shot pound cakes when we give other people a slap on the hand. And so now we see how important it is to understand this distinction that we're trying to make between Black people on the basis of class and the basis of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, in addition to what you just said, besides, you know, in your analysis of Bill Cosby, where he says that we ought to deal with the behavior itself, or somehow the behavior justifies the consequence. The other thing that needs to be said is that you have individuals, Black males, who are getting shot for the perception of having stolen some pound cake. But ultimately, you find out that they had no pound cake on them. You know, there's no kind of address to that issue.
Right.
And certainly if you do address that issue, then you have to face the fact that it's about more than behavior. I mean, behavior is certainly significant in terms of the way that you're defining it, you know, to indicate somebody's class. But it is also something that we have to think about the behavior or the lack of behavior that is perceived, and yet one still has these, you can still get shot.
Yes, right, you know? Exactly, yes.
So that's a very important point, and I think that that's the one, that's something that Mr. Cosby is also just ignoring. It's a significant point. It's, a lot of people are under fire for just perceptions,
right,
not even having done anything. I was actually listening to, you know, I shouldn't reference this because I can't remember the name of the woman, but I was referencing excuse me one second, please. Yeah, I'm thinking about I'm sorry about that. Somebody just came in, so I had to talk to them for a second. I'm thinking about a woman who does a series of interviews, a documentary with these young Black people. She's in Chicago, actually. Mark Anthony Neal interviewed her a few weeks ago on Left of Black. And he says that, she says that she's been talking to a number of Black youth that one said, you know, he's been living his life, going to school. And then he guesses one day he just woke up Black because, you know, the way he understood, it came to him how the police or just other people within the mainstream America, within American society, are perceiving him. At some point, when he finally understood that it's different from the way that he actually sees himself, that was when he woke up Black. That's what that realization is, when he woke up Black. So in any case, I guess I'm just kind of, what your example is leading me to think about is the other ways that other people are starting to really articulate that little, that missing link, that missing piece that, you know, Bill Cosby sometimes misses or seems to forget, at least when he's discussing the matters in mainstream media. All right. So I like one thing that I do like as we're talking about definitions here. I love the way that you emphasize the various ways in which these terms can be used. For instance, bougie can be seen as positive. Bougie can also be spoken of in negative terms.
Yeah.
Why was that important for you?
It was important because besides the fact that some of these terms are hard to pronounce, and there's debate about how you even spell bougie, and how you pronounce bourgeois, which isn't outside of academic spheres, commonly used phrase in the world. It's important to talk about all the ways in which these terms, bourgeois and bougie, are taken up and understood variously, because one reader might say, hey, I've always understood bougie to be a fun loving term where, you know, it's light chiding of somebody. It's not meant to be overly critical, where someone else may see bougie as being very, very critical. Mm-hmm. So it's important to understand those various definitions because they reflect the way in which performances are represented and understood.
Good. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for that response. All right. So performance in the U.S. context has much to do with the history of passing. And, you know, when most people think of passing, they think of Blacks who were able to cross over into the white world, right, due to their skin tone, along with performance, right? But the concept of passing is useful too when we talk about middle class performance, right?
Yes.
I think your discussion or the distinctions you make between representation and presentation speak to that.
Yes, that's right. I wanna say something about passing. Most people think about passing in a reductive or simple sense, that if a person had the hair texture straight, blonde, so to speak, eye color and skin phenotype, light skin, very light skin, that they could pass for white.
Mm-hmm.
But they very seldomly think about how that person also had to behave in a certain kind of way. And usually the passing black person who was passing for white couldn't behave as a lower class black person. I mean, I'm sorry, as a lower class white person, because that class would be, that class performance would be a way to call out their blackness, because black has always been equated with a lower class identity.
Right.
So the passing character, and you look at the passing novels at the early turn of the 20th century, well up through the Harlem Renaissance, these people were performing middle class persona because middle class was associated with being white. The other thing to think about when we talk about passing is that black people who were dark skinned found other ways of passing as non-black people.
Right.
In other words, they were they were passing as someone who was not a citizen of the United States, because to be a citizen of the United States and black means that you're subject to Jim Crow laws.
That's right.
Or were, you know, before 1954. But if you were a black person who was a non-U.S. citizen or a non-black U.S. citizen, then you could subvert those Jim Crow laws and have some privileges that white people have. One example of this is in Booker T. Washington's Up From Slavery, in which he tells of a Moroccan man, dark-skinned man, was speaking English, staying at a hotel, and the townspeople were up in arms, and they wanted to lynch him for staying apparently in this segregated hotel. And then they brought the man out, and he was like, "Hey, I'm Moroccan. I am not a black man. I'm Moroccan." And he started to use his native language, and he found it advantageous. Booker T. Washington said that while he was traveling in the U.S., not to use English.
Right.
Because people would mistake him as African-American. And then other literary figures like Zora Neale Hurston, for instance, writes about passing as an Asiatic princess when she was working as a secretary for Fanny Hurst and getting into the famous Astor Hotel, which was segregated, and other examples. What's really also important about this, Sherry, to me, is that it shows a being middle class in and of itself is not enough.
Yes.
U.S.
Yes.
If you're an African American.
That's true. Yes. Yes. I remember the first time I, in reading your text, I remember the first time that passing as a non-U.S. citizen black, and the, how do I want to say, the benefits, maybe the benefits that, that accompanied that sort of passing, was when I first read Angela Davis's first, her autobiography. She talks about being in Alabama. Do I have that right? I think so. In the South, when she was just a child, she and her sister would go into the store, and they wouldn't be able, they wouldn't be served. They knew that they wouldn't be served, and they would get in trouble to a shoe store or hat store, one of the two. And what they did one day was they went in and pretended to be French and were speaking French. And they found out, she writes this in her, her text, she found that they were allowed to try on the shoes. They were allowed to try on the hats. They were treated exactly as the white Americans were treated.
Yes.
I mean, it blew my mind, because that was when I was introduced to this, this idea of passing as, this is deeper. This is not just a black and white thing, but race in America, there seems to be a particular thing we're talking about within the U.S., particularly white mainstream, when we talk about black Americans, native born Americans. I mean, we could get into that conversation. It's pretty deep. But I want to really get into or highlight for our listeners something that I think is fabulous about your text as well. And it is the organization of it and your decision to, let me say, when I think about the organization of your text, I can't help but think of African American narrative conventions of blurring fact and truth.
Yeah.
It enacts that very nicely. because you have four sections: performing responsibility, performing womanhood, performing media, and performing sexuality. And within each of those sections, you have essays, as well as poetry, as well as fiction, short stories, plays. I mean, just lovely, just very, very lovely. Can you talk about your decision and how to organize the book? Is it something that happened organically, or is it something intentional from the very beginning?
It was very intentional.
Okay, good, good. I should have, given your background in performance art, it makes sense that it's intentional.
It was extremely intentional. I want to say that I am really bothered by academics who believe that that scholars, in order to be valid, have to speak or write in a very high academic prose. I think that's ridiculous.
Yes.
I'm not against that mm-hmm. prose style. Mm-hmm. I'm against the unequivocal requirement for all scholars to produce in that manner. Mm-hmm. I think that it excludes the mainstream public from important academic conversations and debates.
Yeah.
And one of the ways of challenging that reification is to use creative works,
yes.
which are often not seen as academic in nature,
right.
but they are quite rhetorical in terms of being persuasive, of getting points across. I mean, when we think about the Black Arts Movement and the Black Power Movement, mm-hmm. poetry, drama, fiction, those were the vehicles used to drive home important arguments about race, politics, government, et cetera.
Right.
And so, yeah, it was quite intentional for me and my assistant editor to include those creative works
mm-hmm.
because they're important. Also, performance studies as a discipline doesn't make a distinction between creative works and academic essays. In other words, those scholars do them both. They do creative works and academic essays, and one is not necessarily more privileged than the other. They're both equally privileged, and we engage in the both.
Okay, good. Good. Now, I'm going to ask that you speak a little bit about performing responsibility. I think it's important to just reiterate for our listeners that the main thread, or one of the main threads within the text, is or foundations is E. Franklin Frazier's the book that he published in 1957 on the Black middle class. And so, in talking about responsibility, you know, the way in which he defines responsibility counters notions of uplift, you know, or upliftment, right? It's about somehow maintaining, as opposed to assimilating with white mainstream culture, it is about maintaining Black culture, identity, and spirituality, as he says on page 23. What, explain for me some of the complexities of responsibility that, as we think about responsibility in the way that Frazier outlined it, and then in other ways that we've seen, if we look back at, you know, the Talented Tenth, etc.
Wow, that's a really tough question.
Oh, is it? Sorry.
Well, let me say that the section on the opening section and on responsibility is really important because racial uplift has always been important to Black people. And I think that we still have a tendency to think about racial uplift in very reductive and now problematic terms, where we're trying to pave a way for lower class or poor African Americans in order to uplift the entire race. I mean, which goes back to W.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington and some others, right?
Mm-hmm.
Prominent figures in racial uplift discourse.
Yeah.
But I think that responsibility alludes to that discussion, but it also alludes to the discussion of what is my connection as a middle-class Black man to the overall Black community, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it also speaks to sometimes that no man's land or no woman's land that middle-class Black people find themselves in, especially if you're like you or me, where we move in predominantly white environments for work, and sometimes in our social settings, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not we can be fully accepted in those environments or not.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what is my responsibility to try to maintain a connection to the Black community, but also what is the Black community responsibility to me?
There are
different takes on this. And so the book doesn't try to answer that question.
Right.
That section, as much as it tries to present an array of problems. It opens with one of the premier figures in African-American studies and African-American literary studies, Houston Baker, who talks about his shift in understanding his role and relationship to the Black community.
Yeah.
But then it ends with another premier figure, Amiri Baraka, who has been fairly consistent in his critique of Black middle-class people who he thinks or argues sort of pimp lower class Black people for their own success.
Thank you for saying the question initially was a difficult or a complex one, but I thought that you answered it really nicely in your intro too, as you did here, but I derived it from your intro where if you don't mind my quoting you, you say that leadership is not only about occupying a political office like the presidency. It is about one's responsibility to family, to community, to the race. One carries out this responsibility in various roles. And this is the thing that I really wanted to emphasize or thought was important. One's in various roles as the one who has made it in an otherwise lower class family, as a major figure in an academic field, as an administrator of a university, or as someone who runs a community institution designed to promote racial and economic success for Blacks. And so that's, what I want listeners to get from one of the things that you do within this text and all of the contributors is that you look at responsibility in a very diverse way. And so that leadership then is defined out in outside ways than we think of them conventionally, right? It opens up and just kind of, maybe it doesn't open up. Maybe it's always been this way within Black communities, but reminds us that leadership is not simply just holding a political office, that you and or I have responsibility and can be leaders in our various spaces.
Yes, yes, that's right. That's right.
Okay, good. Thank you. So the last question I want to ask you, just because I know we've taken up a lot of your time here, is I want to see if I can find a question that will merge performing womanhood, performing sexuality, and performing media. And I think that we can do that if we think about gender.
Yes.
And the amount of pressure or weight that has historically been placed on Black women or Black girls as representations or representers of the race. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
I do. I think that when you're talking about Black girls, perhaps you're referring to the opening essays in the section on performing womanhood, where Nazira Wright and Claire Oberon Garcia talk about the Black girl figure as being representers of racial uplift.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting. And they do a much better job than I could even do here in summarizing their arguments.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, there is no section on Black manhood.
Yes, yes.
And that is very, very, very particular, because this book is designed to sort of think about topics that we haven't really considered in response to Blackness. Mm-hmm. And womanhood is one of those areas that Black feminists have said we need to pay very close attention to. Mm-hmm. And I think still at this late date in the feminist or womanist, I should say, for Black people movements, that we still are not as conversant on issues dealing with women as we should be.
Yeah.
And so it was very important to have that section. Gender and sexuality, though, affects Black people overall.
Yes.
And what this book is trying to do, too, is to show how no cultural dimension, no specific aspect of identity is separate from the other. We cannot separate race from class. We cannot separate race from class from gender. And we cannot separate race from class from gender from sexuality. It just doesn't happen.
Yes.
And so it ends with this section on sexuality and gender, because those are intricately connected to our understanding of racial performance. Mm-hmm. You raised the question about the artwork early, and so I want to talk a little bit about it.
Yes.
The cover art and the inserts for every section, there's a character representation for each section, is done by my good friend Jing Berry, who's an artist from Iowa. Mm-hmm. And I asked the press if we could use the some artwork from Jing Berry for the cover, and they saw it and fell in love with it.
Yes.
And if you look at it, some people have commented that it doesn't directly amplify the title of the book, mm-hmm. but there's four sort of ambiguously gendered characters on the cover. They're kind of masculinized in a certain way, but they're feminized too. And they're sort of like incarnations and movements within African American class struggle and class identity. Mm-hmm. So that's why there's four here on the cover, and it's sort of like saying we're not stuck in slavery, we're not stuck in Reconstruction, we're not stuck in the Harlem Renaissance, we're not stuck in Jim Crow, but all of our history informs our present. Mm-hmm. And so that's what that representation is.
Yeah, I mean, and then of course when you talk on I'm missing it here, on Annie Lee's art.
Deborah Whaley.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I was just about to pull out her name. Yes. The essay in which she speaks about Annie Lee, the characteristic when she's speaking about Annie Lee, I look back at all of the art within the text as well, because one of the links was the faceless figures. And I just love that allows I know that it's not an installation, but it is kind of where you can insert yourself and become a part of, read yourself or people you know into these images that we're seeing here. Fabulous. I think that the text definitely, we haven't even scratched the surface in our conversation. And I'm not sure that we would be able to get through all of the richness of the text here. So I highly encourage everyone out there to take a look at this text, because it's important. It's important.
Thank you.
And you do a wonderful job. Everyone inside the text, all the contributors do as well. Especially, man, I wish we could talk more about the blues women in the Black church.
No, I know.
Oh, Greg Tate's essay on Afro punks.
Yes.
Man. All right. So I want to ask you before we close, what are you doing now? We want to hear more from you, Rashawn. What are you doing now?
And you will. I'm a workaholic. So I'm working on several things right now. I'm working on an anthology of African American rhetoric that pulls together primary works from colonization to present day. So things like Nikki Finney's National Book Award acceptance speech, August Wilson's speech, The Ground on Which We Stand. Mm-hmm. These are primary texts, mm-hmm. primary rhetorical texts within the African-American tradition. We have a lot of anthologies on African-American literature. And we have the famous ones, the Norton Anthology and the Riverside.
Yes.
But we don't have any compendium on African-American rhetoric.
Yes.
And so I am doing that with two co-editors, Michelle Bachelor Robinson and Carmen Kennard. Mm-hmm. I'm also working on a monograph called Straight Black Queers, Gender Anxiety and the American Dream, that I'm looking at Barack, Michelle Obama, August Wilson, and the journalist Leonita McLean for how being a middle class person who has made it really means that those persons experience gender anxiety in America. Mm-hmm. Just how much race impacts our Black people's perception of who they are as men and women and what it means to be a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I call the book Straight Black Queers, because it's not a focus on queer sexuality as much as it is on the gender identity being queer when it comes to the idealized version of womanhood or manhood.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, look, we are looking forward to the work that you are, your upcoming work. And if, you know, if From Bourgeois to Bougie, Black Middle Class Performances is any indication, we know it's going to be a nice, complex, titillating mixture of, art, fine art, as well as, critical works. And so we're looking forward to the work that you are coming up with. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you, and we wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
All right. Goodbye.
You're listening to the interview series, New Books in African American Studies. Today, I've been talking with Professor Vershawn Ashanti Young, and he's been discussing his new book, From Bourgeois to Bougie, Black Middle Class Performances. I'm your host, Sherry Johnson, and I look forward to seeing you next time.